So we're resuming our look at the book by Christine Maluhi called Miniskirts, Mothers and Muslims. She gives a subheading, Modelling Spiritual Values in Muslim Culture. And she means modelling Christian spiritual values in Muslim culture. We've looked at almost half the book, and now we're going quickly through these shorter chapters to have a presentation by different people. So, Catherine, your chapter is chapter 3, To Veil or Not to Veil, and the subheading is Historical Muslim and Christian Veiling.
The subject matter is about to veil or not to veil. The author's approach to this subject is she covers three aspects. Firstly, the historical Muslims and Christian veiling. From ancient times, respectable dress for Eastern women are veiling and continues to be so in many countries until today. Veiling is pre-Islamic and was still considered a necessary modesty for Christian women in the first century. The old Roman Catholic nuns' habit carries on the tradition in Western Christian circles. However, in Arabic, beyond the scope of the Greco-Roman Empire, women did not practice veiling until the Prophet Muhammad's wife were obliged to veil, apparently as a sign of honor. Soon after, all Muslim women adopted veiling. Abdullah Yusuf Ali says in the Quran and commentary, he said, tell your daughters and wife and the believing women that they should cast their outer garments over their person when they go abroad. That is most convenient, that they should be known and not molested. In Quran, Surah chapter 33, verse 59. And this is for Muslim women. The times were for those of insecurity, and they were asked to cover themselves with a long gown covering the whole body or a cloak covering the neck and bosom. The object was not to restrict the liberty of women, but to protect them from harm and molestation under the condition then existing in Arabia. Christian veiling, William Buckley, one of the most brilliant Christian expositors of this age, particularly in ancient literature and biblical history, has important comments about veil in his commentary on 1 Corinthians chapter 11. There are different Greek words with specific meaning for the English translation of veil or head covering. To read the text with this distinction, give us this translation. In chapter 11, verse 4, every man praying or prophesying with a head covering dishonor his head, but every woman who prayed or prophesies with her head uncovered dishonor her head, for that is one and the same thing as if her head was shaved. Verse 6, for if a woman does not completely veil herself, in Buckley's commentary in Arabic, the word used is hijab. Let her also be shorn. But if it is shameful for a woman to be shorn, punishment for a prostitute, then let her be completely covered. Verse 7, the man ought not to be completely covered, since he is the image and glory of God, but a woman is the glory of man. Verse 10, for this reason, a woman ought to have a symbol of authority on her head because of the angels. The veil was a great protection. In 1 Corinthians chapter 11, verse 10 is very difficult to translate. We have translated it, for this reason, a woman ought to retain upon her head a sign that she is under someone else's authority. but the Greek literally means that a woman ought to retain her authority upon her head. Sir William Ramsay explained it this way: in Oriental land, the will is the power and honour and dignity of the woman.
Okay, thank you very much. That's very helpful. And I think we'll move on to the fourth chapter, chapter four, which is advice from modern Muslim women leaders.
Okay, and I won't pronounce all of their names because I can't pronounce them, but basically she has different women giving advice, and one of the ladies said that as going over there, we need to be more reserved in our appearance than ordinary women in regards to the way we walk, the way we talk, and the way we dress. She said, when you dress simply and talk seriously, they will take you more seriously. Another lady said she dresses in Islamic dress by choice because it tends to strengthen her character and confirms her independence. It's also comfortable, practical, and smart. She says it's very suitable for being able to go out and mix among the people to be covered up. She doesn't have to worry about anything if she just goes ahead and does it. Another lady says she wears the Islamic dress when she needs to go out and mix with men. Even if it wasn't required, she would rather do that just because she wants people to listen to her brain rather than her body. And she says it's not a matter of just your clothing, but in the way you speak, your voice patterns, and also your movements, too. Another lady said, women are to be taken as the honor of the family, the source of its pride or its shame. And I think as long as you keep that in mind, no matter what you're doing, certainly you need to remain yourself and be yourself, but you also need to take into consideration, you know, what they're thinking as well. And you should appear and dress respectfully. One of the questions they asked was, how does a Western woman break down the barriers, gain a good reputation, and influence society all at the same time? And they said that, well, you just play a role in the society. You get out there and you're seen, but you're seen trying to take on their culture and their ways, and that will make a big impact on them. And they used one of the ladies as an example, and she went in, actually she was a feminist, and went in and became the queen of the town, and her biggest tip was habit helps. The more you do it, the more it will become a habit. So, I think that was
thank you very much. Very helpful.
Thank you.
We'll move straight on to chapter five, modeling spiritual values in the home, and the subtitle here, persuasive family relationships.
Okay, in this chapter, initially she discusses biblical submission of a woman to a man as opposed to Islamic submission. And she just pointed out that our role as Christians is for the woman to choose to submit as obedience to God, not to be forced to submit by the man. And she said, women offering voluntary submission gives the death blow to men's fears of their liberation and rebellion. So in other words, there wouldn't have need for the oppression if women would voluntarily submit. And she also said that many Muslims do notice differences in Christian marriages and Christian families. She said when they had people over to their home, they would comment on that, and she didn't even know what they had done. They had just been being normal as they were every day. Another big part of this chapter was just the idea of modeling by example, especially as a wife and a mother. She spent quite a bit of time on this. She said, especially as a wife and a mother, you don't need to go out and have your own ministry and disciple and teach the Bible. It's just as big or bigger a ministry to be in your home taking care of your children and having people over to your home to see that Christianity can be lived out daily. Otherwise, converts will see that you go out and you disciple and you minister all the time, and they'll feel like, well, I can't be a good Christian because I have to take care of my home and my kids and do the laundry and all this other stuff, and so I can't do all the good Christian things. So she, it was really encouraging to me, and I'm sure to other people who might have families and children to take care of in that area of the world. She also mentioned hospitality and the importance of that, and something I hadn't really heard in this way before was that in the Islamic world, there's something very important about sharing food with someone, food and drink. And she mentioned the bread covenant, that if you eat bread with someone, you're covenanting with them to be their friend. And she mentioned several examples of men who were assigned to spy on a certain Christian family or to deport them or something, and they would go over to their home like a friend and be offered food and drink, and they would refuse and refuse and refuse. And later it was found out that they were actually spying, and they would not break their own conscience by sharing bread with this family that they knew they were deceiving. So it's very important to share bread with people and show, she said, that's a sign of love. Food is a sign of love. And that's about it.
Thank you very much, Laurie. That was very helpful indeed. And now our brother, the pastor, he's going to take this subject of chapter 6, Christ's model for discipleship, briefly.
I'm glad she said briefly. Chapter 6, she describes Christ's models for discipleship. A couple of things I want to bring out, first of all, is that she talked briefly about being a disciple or what the disciple meant and what Jesus did with and for his disciples. And number two, that a new convert should be equipped and should not be released to witness as soon as we allow them to do so. She talked about Christ gave his disciples a pattern in John chapter 17, and he spoke as he spoke to the Father. Also in John chapter 17, verse 6, every time he was around them meaning his disciples, and of course he will be Jesus, he revealed the Father, meaning Jesus showed the character of the Father when he was around his disciples. He showed them that God was like, that he was like God, and he endeavored to bring them to God or to bring them into the body of Christ. He gave them the Word of God, and of course we know John says that Jesus is the Word, or in the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God. But he also took time to help them and to love them. She brings up the point that verse 17 or verse 9, he prayed for them, he protected them in the Father's name, and he held them close and nurtured them, and he guarded them. These are the things that Jesus did for his disciples, and how can we protect our believers? And she brought out this point that we can protect them from premature harassment, in this case, she said, by the police. And she said, if we advise the new converts of what to expect, then they can adhere to those things. But if we use the testimony and put them out front, then they will experience some harassment from those people who were in the world, and they might not be ready to receive this type of harassment. So she was guarding against us talking. She said, we are, as believers, are like hens which lay eggs, and everyone must hear about it. We talk too much, is what she was saying. We talk too much many times, and we don't spend time in doing the incubation stages when those converts are first, the eggs are hatched, then we want to get up and go around and just tell everybody about everything. But she said many times the chicken is killed because we leave them during the incubation stage. But she said we need to be more like turtles, which put their eggs and hide their eggs and then leave them until they're mature. And that's what we need to do. And there's an extreme danger that the baby Christian can die. Also, she said something about glorifying Christ on earth means to pour our lives into someone else until God's character is manifest in him or her. And then lastly, she says that the disciples were called upon to do nothing that they didn't see the teacher do. This is a pattern that we should follow, and we should identify the woman's lives and teach them. Teach them by example of how to live the life of depending on God in their circumstances.
Thank you very much, brother. Mm-hmm. And the seventh chapter, Jennifer, will you give us your summary and comments? It's on gatherings, fellowship, or frustration.
Okay.
I just wanted to add that I found this chapter very interesting and very helpful to me as a church planner in dealing with cell groups and small groups, and it was helpful for that. And overall, this chapter is basically about how to effectively begin small groups and cell groups. The author stresses the importance of fellowship and the spiritual significance of shared experiences and memories. And she talks about how important it is to have fun with the people, to go out as couples or families. And she had the example of an amusement park and spending time on a boat with the people. They were more interested in that experience. It fostered more of an atmosphere, spirituality for them. We were so used to going and having a structured environment where we go to somebody's home, we start a Bible study, and then afterwards we have fellowship time where we eat together and we talk and we relax and let down . Whereas for them, she expressed that it's better to do that beforehand, to develop an atmosphere where you're just sitting around, casual, talking for a while, and then, in that, create a time of sharing God's word and fellowship. And going on here, the author also speaks of the importance of modeling Christ's love and the Christian life. Again, that's the theme, it seems, throughout the entire book. She says later in this chapter, the author, she mentions that new believers often have a burden of bringing shame on their families by their faith, and this is very difficult for them. And so she suggests that to foster their growth and development, and so to speak, disciple them, is to have, especially with singles, to take them in your own home as part of your family, and just take them in, two or three believers, and just kind of, I think actually many of the homes probably they're thrown out of their family. So taking them in and fostering that relationship is important for them to grow. Let's see here, what else? Let me have here. They also, again, the author stresses the importance of a friendship and how we need to be more concerned with people as far as, I think in our society, we're very task-oriented, and it's easy to do this. I know in evangelism is to think of, yes, I want to win this person to the Lord, and we're so task-oriented, but as opposed to that, to be more focused on fostering a relationship, and she uses a great example on page 94, which I don't think we have time to go into, but that would be good.
Thank you very much. Uh-huh. That's fine. Uh-huh. Good. So we'll move on to chapter 8, and Tina's going to talk about it. The heading of the chapter is Favors and Favorites. Favors and Favorites. Reciprocal Giving, the Favor System.
Okay, this is something that I had heard about, and I never really quite understood the Eastern thought on this whole idea of reciprocal giving. But she starts out the chapter by saying, a consistent problem often discussed with great frustration by nationals and Westerners is the different idea of the bounds and claims of friendship. She says that Arabs say that Westerners are selfish, cold-hearted, and not true friends. Westerners say that the Arabs make large requests at inconvenient or inappropriate times and then are offended when their request is not granted. And so she goes on to help us to understand the Eastern mindset on this whole idea of favors and gifts and reciprocal giving. She says that the Arab culture revolves around the reciprocal giving and receiving of favors and gifts, and that this ties in with the system of community living and relationships. And whereas we, as Westerners, have the idea of being an individual in control of our life and not dependent on anybody else. But to them, that is a totally foreign idea because there is no individual. It's all community. And so she says that she says, if we are not willing to give of ourselves and put aside our sterile programs for flesh and blood people, we are not true friends. And then she gives some rules. She says, giving and receiving gifts is part of this reciprocal system, and there are parameters that we need to be aware of in order to play by the rules. And the parameters are, if someone excessively admires something, you must give it to them. So if they come into your house and they excessively admire those slip-on shoes that we could wear to the mosque on Friday, that Miss Stacy would have to give them to us. And so that's one of them. And then if we admire something in their house and they offer it to us and we don't take it, it's considered a great offense. And so you would have to, if you admire something and they offer it to you, that you would have to take that, that you'd have to take that gift. The clincher there is that acceptance of a gift means accepting the obligation to return a gift of greater value. Although usually if you give them a gift of equal value, they'll usually take that. But appropriate value must be weighed up in terms of the value of time, energy, or money. And so so you have to take all those things into consideration. One of the things that she does make clear, though, is that if you're going out of your way to be helpful to someone, that is not a favor. That's your duty. And so you can't say that that's a favor that, that you need to be reciprocated for. And she also says, a careful mental account is kept of favors and gifts given, and these must be paid. So this chapter gives us a better idea of the Eastern mindset on this whole idea of reciprocal giving and favors.
Thank you very much. And now the last chapter, which is very short. Stacy, you're going to say something about it. The heading is In a Nutshell. That's another word for a few words for conclusion, I think. Thank you.
I thought I would just read a quote that she said beautifully sums up what she's been trying to express throughout the whole book. And it's a quote from E. Stanley Jones, who's a missionary in India. It says, I felt that we who come from a foreign land should have the inward feeling, if not the outward sign, of being adopted sons of India, and we should offer our message as a homage to our adopted land. Respect should characterize our very attitude. India should be home, her future, our future, and we her servants for Jesus' sake.
Thank you very much. I hope that you will all be able to buy a copy sometime of this book, because it's a very helpful book, as you've seen. And we will, maybe there are things that you would like to discuss about it, and maybe we'll have that opportunity some other time. Meanwhile, I have to say that I'm today moving into the office that someone has kindly lent me, so that no one admires my laptop.